You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So welcome to this week's episode. If you're listening today on the 13th of January, this is coming out a little bit late because my mic broke. And that ended up being on Amazon customer services line for like an hour. Although I have to say they were very helpful, but they tried to fob me off onto the manufacturer. And I was like, well, I bought the mic through you. So after a bit of a tussle, they gave me a refund. So anyway, that's why this is a bit late. But in today's episode, I'd like to talk about surrogacy. And the reason why is I came across an article last week, and the article was talking about like what is happening in Italy right now, where like the far right government has essentially tried to erode all the rights that same-sex couples have. So like initially they said that same-sex couples wouldn't be able to access IVF any longer. Then they said that same-sex couples could no longer adopt. And then in recent months, they said that, you know, effective very soon, couples in general, a blanket ban on couples' ability to go abroad to have children via surrogacy. Now, it's clearly connected to the other policies they've passed that are seeking to claw back the rights that same-sex couples have won. And, you know, I was conflicted hearing like this story because on the one hand, like obviously as a gay person myself, I feel very empathetic towards people who are going to lose rights, even just like the social pressure and the social climate they must be living in. Also for the people who already have families, like the legal nightmare this must be for them, the heightened sense of insecurity and maybe even like safety that they're going to experience. Like clearly I feel very empathetic to them. But, and also I imagine myself in the same situation, how I would definitely leave. I would leave straight away, but it would be a very traumatic thing to happen to a family already formed. But then simultaneously, you know, I also had to revisit what I think about surrogacy because, you know, and the last time I probably gave it some thought is probably during university when I debated the subject a couple of times. And in general, I was anti it because of the exploitation that is often associated with surrogacy, especially like surrogacy where it is international in nature and it's basically like wealthy couples from developed countries going to poorer countries to you know, have women be their surrogates. So that, like, I haven't probably thought about it in like 7-8 years. So I wanted to go back and really like think about it, read stuff around it, watch videos from both pros and cons of people talking about their experiences, and also considering just sort of like whether I would feel differently if I had to go through that method to have a child, because obviously I'm a woman, so I've got a womb, so I will never have to go through the hardship, you know, hopefully, of not being able to have a child. So I was trying to think, is it speaking from a position of privilege that I don't have to worry about that, that I'm being like negative or dismissive or judgmental or in general not having a positive attitude towards surrogacy. So anyway, I have a conclusion, and that's what this episode is going to be about. Now, before I set off, you know, on the discussion, for anybody who doesn't know what surrogacy is, it's simply an arrangement that's often supported by like a legal agreement or a legal contract whereby a woman agrees to pregnancy and to childbirth, and she does it on behalf of like either like a straight couple, like gay couple, or sometimes even single people. And usually the reason why the couples go to surrogates to have children is because they've got infertility issues or some kind of other medical issues that prevents them from being able to safely bring to term a child. And there's different types of surrogacies as well. There are surrogacies where it'll be like the couple who is seeking a child will use a donor egg and donor sperm. Sometimes they're just using a donor egg because they've got sperm. And then sometimes in other situations, they will use the egg of the surrogate mother, in which case the child would be biologically both the parent who are commissioning the child, if you will, and then also their surrogate mothers. So different types. And then also in terms of like compensation, like many countries in Europe in particular basically have banned like surrogacy where you pay money, where you pay like $50,000 or £15,000 to have a woman have your child. And instead what they have is like a reasonable expense system where the woman can't be paid, but the couple or the person who's commissioning the child basically pays for her expenses. And then you have other countries where it's a straight up cash exchange. So a great variation in that. Now, for me, the reason why I have always had reservations around surrogacy is because I think about it in the context of how I feel about prostitution as a whole. And that often it is, I mean, I guess it depends on the kind of like media you consume. But from the stuff that I see from like uber liberal left, because I would categorize myself as a liberal left person, is that I often disagree with how it's caricatured or how it's characterized. To me, it's characterized as like this new age empowering thing where sex work is not about the exploitation of women and it's not about the commodification of the female form. It isn't about the women who are economically coerced, i.e. they don't have money for whatever reason, and they resort to sex work because it's their only option. So for me, like, I feel about it in a similar way. Like, in my head, women would only, outside exceptional circumstances, outside, like, you're doing it for your sister, you're doing it for a close friend who can't conceive for whatever reason. For me, the motivating factor is money. People do it because they need the money. It's not because it's empowering. It's not because they're just like these altruistic, like angels of women who are willing to put their bodies through what pregnancy goes through. And, you know, I've seen some videos. It is extreme stuff, especially delivery. And also just like the complications that can often occur for women who are in poorer countries where the healthcare facilities aren't as good. It's a massive endeavor. And so for me, like all this chat about how it's like they're doing it out of graciousness and kindness and they're doing it because it's empowerment and because they love the feeling of pregnancy. Like, sure, maybe some people feel that way, but for me, it's like prostitution. Like most women do it because they need the money. They're economically coerced, if you will. So when I was looking at the research, I wanted to see if that is true. And one thing that surprised me that kind of challenged this was that I found out that actually a lot of surrogacy takes place in the US. So in my mind's eye, it was something like the overwhelming majority of like global or international surrogacy took place where the mothers were from poorer countries. But actually estimates put the number of surrogacies or surrogates that are US-based at about 25 to 40%. So it's a decent amount of people, it's a decent chunk. And when you think about the reason why that number is so high, it kind of becomes clear. So a lot of parents choose the US because of the legal protection it offers them. So it recognizes them as their parents, they're able to take their children home. There's also like an acceptance of the contracts between surrogate mothers and the commissioning parents. So people choose the US as a destination primarily because of the legal protection it gives them. And then also because they've got very good healthcare facilities, like if you can afford them. And so they know that there's less likely to be complications where those can't be dealt with. And therefore their child's safety is more guaranteed. So, you know, it was a larger chunk than I was expecting. And that's very good news. Now, like all those things also are the reason why the other 60 to 75% of international surrogacy ends up taking place in poorer countries is because the US is more expensive. So the average cost of surrogacy, like i.e. the money that commissioning parents pay the surrogate mothers, ranges between $50,000 and $100,000. And so because that's inaccessible, unattainable for the average person, like couples who want to have a child through surrogacy obviously are going to be driven to external markets where the price is much lower. So you see that although 25 to 40% of surrogacy is in the US, because the cost of paying like surrogate mothers, and because of the cost of the associated healthcare, and because of the even like the cost associated with like the legal dynamics of handing over the parenting rights from the surrogate mother to the commissioned parents, all that adds up, you end up seeing that people look elsewhere. And when you focus on the chunk of people, so the 60 to 75% of surrogacies that take place externally or external to the US, you see that there's a very clear pattern of where the people who are commissioning these children are coming from and where the surrogate mothers are from. And what you see is that it is like commissioning parents from wealthy countries, i.e. the US or Canada or the UK, and they're going to poorer countries in the global south initially until like a couple of like not a couple, many countries started banning it. And then they migrated back to Eastern European countries that have looser regulation and where just the level of income is significantly lower. So as an example, if you consider that in the UK, so in the UK, you can't pay a woman like direct cash for like carrying your child or carrying a child on your behalf. What you can do though is pay her for reasonable expenses, and the government caps that figure at £15,000. £15,000 in USD is roughly about $18,000. So when you look at the countries that are the highest ranking outside the US, you see countries like India where the average income per year per person is $10,000. Nepal, the average income per person per year is $5,000. In Thailand, it's $22,000. In Eastern European countries like the Ukraine, it's about $18,000. And so even if they weren't allowed to be paid like direct cash sums, but could only be like given the reasonable expenses budget, as is the UK, i.e. the £15,000 or the $18,000 I spoke about, this would still represent a windfall, like a massive amount of money to these women's lives, because they couldn't make that amount of money in a year. And so you see like a very clear economic incentive that drives them making this choice. And you also see that the income inequality, the global income inequality, is clearly factoring in. The fact that all the commissioning parents almost exclusively are coming from wealthy countries like the US and Canada and the UK. And then all the surrogate mothers are coming exclusively from poor income countries, like the countries that I've just listed, tells you that this pattern is only explainable by the economic circumstances, by the income inequality or the disparity of incomes in these two groups of people. And if that wasn't the case, like quite simply, you would see surrogate mothers being represented in a more even way. So you would see like equivalent or similar numbers of mothers from wealthy countries like Japan or Germany or France or the UK. But because that's not the case, it tells you that clearly money and the economic disparity is a massive motivating factor for this pattern. Another thing that kind of gives us a clue that, you know, women are doing this for the money is when you look at countries in the global south that, you know, they have subsequently banned surrogacy for foreign couples. But you see at the time, the reason why the bans even took place was because they came to realize that a lot of these women were essentially being pimped out by criminal organizations into carrying children for these like foreign couples. So women would be coerced physically, they'd be coerced through like blackmail, they'd be coerced like psychologically with the threat of violence into carrying endless numbers of children with the criminal gangs working in surrogacy agencies and clearly benefiting from the exploitation of these women. Even when you look at the experiences of women from Eastern European countries, you notice that they are much more transparent about the reason why they came to surrogacy. And I can tell you that the majority, the overwhelming majority of them do it because they are in a bad economic situation, to the extent that since Russia has waged a war against the Ukraine, the number of surrogacy in the country, in the Ukraine, has increased clearly because people are suffering even more. Women are suffering even more economically, and they're having to resort to more extreme measures to keep themselves and their families afloat. And so given that the majority of women, whether they're located in poorer countries like India or Thailand or Vietnam or the Ukraine, are doing it out of economic necessity or out of economic coercion, clearly they're not able to give full consent, because full consent can only be given when other people have like the freedom of choice in a true sense. Like if I have no way of feeding myself and my family and I might lose my home, I might be rendered homeless, then if somebody makes me an offer to make like $18,000 by subjecting my body to pregnancy, and I've got no other avenue or no other way of making equivalent sums of money, of course I'm going to say yes if that's all that's left to me, especially because the other option might be to go into prostitution. And so relatively speaking, it's a less difficult thing to do, I guess you could say, or it's a less like degrading thing to do. So again, like most of the women are coming from poor countries, and they're doing it specifically to get money to help themselves and their families. Another thing you can see that this is clearly the what's happening is, for example, in Georgia in 2020, 98% of all intended parents in commercial surrogacy arrangements were for foreigners. So Georgian, as in the country. Georgian women, like 98% of all women who were surrogate mothers, were doing it for the foreign market. And if it was like all about altruism and wasn't economically motivated, you would expect them to be also be surrogates for women in Georgia, like women in their own country. And so clearly the fact that foreign wealthy couples can offer a significant amount of money that is life-changing for them is a massive driver for them. So again, like as far as I'm concerned, I honestly don't believe that women are in a position to give consent, because it's basically their last option. And one of the things that I was happy to see was that in many countries have actually banned surrogacy, specifically surrogacy for foreign couples, because of these issues. So for example, India banned it in 2015 after like scandals of like these criminal gangs that were pimping out women and forcing them to like carry these pregnancies came out. Nepal banned it in 2016. Georgia actually just banned it in 2024, the end of 2024. And Thailand will have a ban in 2025. I think it was supposed to start or supposed to be effective as of January 2025. So clearly the pattern of surrogacy is that countries are increasingly recognizing how exploitative it is of women, how coercive it is of women, and how the economic coercion means that women will basically put up with a great deal of physical abuse, as I'll talk about later, because basically it's their last option and because they don't have alternative choices or alternative equivalent good choices. Now, moving away from just like the economic coercion, I think I belabored that point, is like one of the things I came across a lot, especially in like surrogacy advocacy, was this idea of it being a right. And one of the things I was kind of annoyed at as well was how they were using like same-sex couples as the face of the campaign, when the overwhelming majority of couples who use surrogacy are not same-sex couples, and they're basically putting them on the front lines to like be the recipients of like the vitriol and kind of incentivizing like far-right governments to make them the target of their campaigns. Of their like anti-same-sex campaigns. And what it's resulting in is actually the same-sex couples losing even more access or even more of their rights because of them being sort of the face of the quote-unquote movement. But outside of that, like the language being used around it being a right for every person to be able to have a child, and how surrogacy is not so much about the exploitation of women, but it's about women facilitating other people's rights, I guess, to having children, is completely irrational to me. And it's irrational for like the basic like reason that you don't have a right to another woman's body. You don't have a right to anybody's body. And why, if you don't have a right to sex, for example, because you're not entitled to use another person's body for gratification, why would you be entitled to another person's body, like, for procreation? Why would you be entitled to another person's womb or a woman's womb in general? Especially because, like, one of the things I think about when I hear this sort of argumentation, like the rights part, like the rights-based discourse, is I kind of think, like, not only do you not have a right to a child, you also don't have a right to a biological child. And if you really want a child, you still can have a child. You can adopt the millions, like one of the millions of children who are out there and need a forever home. So I really don't like that discourse because it conflates two things that shouldn't be conflated together. One, like a person's like desire to have a family with the requirement that a woman subject her body and allow her womb to be used for that purpose. The only thing that, you know, I will say though, is that, you know, if they are going to have a ban, I wish they would make it a ban that isn't based on same-sex relationships. Like, if the exploitation of women's bodies for other people's benefit, in this case, to have children, is morally reprehensible or wrong, then it shouldn't matter who the commissioning parents are. It should be wrong because that woman is probably being economically coerced into doing so because you can't guarantee that she has truly consented to exploiting her body in that way. And so it doesn't matter, like, the sexual orientation of the couple. Like, it should just be banned on the basis that it's wrong. So I don't like the weaponization of the surrogacy issue against same-sex relationships and same-sex unions in general. But however, you know, I still don't think it's same-sex couples' rights to have a child through surrogacy. When I was looking at some of like the writings around like the rights-based discourse on surrogacy and specifically focusing on same-sex relationships, but more specific than that, gay men, one of the things I thought was like the contention I feel between the image of surrogacy that is presented to the world where, as far as gay men are concerned, versus like some of the things that I imagine to also be happening like simultaneously, is I think the way it's being presented, especially when they're using the rights-based narrative, is that gay men are so grateful and thankful and so appreciative of women in general and surrogate mothers in particular for giving them like the gift of being able to have like their own children, their own biological children. And because of that gratefulness or appreciation, they basically respect the women, they value the women, they treat the women well. And there's a general baseline level of just like admiration and respect and gratitude. And I just think that that's like kind of a myth in many respects, because at a base level, don't think that gay men are any less misogynistic than straight men, than heterosexual men. And you can actually very easily see it just by how you see them talk about women in like all gay men's like spaces. Like, they'll often be using derogatory terms for things that are associated with women and femininity in general. When you think about, for example, the dating world and how many gay men like don't want to date like feminine men or effeminate men, and how they'll explicitly say things like no femmes, how they will refer to like the man in a couple who is more submissive as like the bottom bitch, how even when they are like in drag and they're cosplaying women, in my opinion, it's often very offensive. Like, I watched like a few episodes of like RuPaul's Drag Race back in the day, and I couldn't even get past like episode 3 and 4 because the language is so anti-woman, so anti the feminine in many respects. So like just casually throwing around the words bitches and fishy and cunt, like in any other context, would be completely unacceptable, but somehow because it's gay men saying it, it's okay. And so I say all of this to say that when it comes to surrogacy and gay men, I don't necessarily believe that they are worshiping the ground that these women walk on. And actually, women's experiences, and this is outside, this is not necessarily just gay men, but one of the experiences of women who are surrogates is that they feel completely like They feel like a cow. They feel like a vessel. They feel like there is no regard for her emotional and physical well-being, and that the men who commission her to have a child will violate her bodily autonomy. They will violate her sense of privacy. And this is embodied on like this article I read about the show called Flipping Out, where the surrogate mother was having a child for a gay couple. And unbeknownst to her, they were like recording the whole birth. And they were like recording her like between her legs, like really up close when she was clearly out of it because she was in the middle of giving birth. And then when the show aired, it had blurred out her privates, but they could be heard. The gay couple could be heard saying the most obscene, derogatory, disgusting things about her genitals, about the way she was giving birth, about how the whole thing looked. So it's like, this is a woman who's actually in the midst of giving your child life, giving you life, giving you an opportunity to have a child, an opportunity to have a family together and have a family unit. And even in that moment, their misogyny is so deeply ingrained that they don't see the miracle that's happening in front of them. They don't see like the sacrifice that this woman is making on their behalf. And also don't forget, like, the woman will be in excruciating pain as they're mocking her right now. So again, like, when I thought about like the rights-based like discourse and like the image that they're painting of gay men, I don't know if they're necessarily bringing this sense of reverence and this sense of awe to the women who are being surrogates for them. Especially because even straight men, like, don't necessarily appreciate, not necessarily, they definitely a lot of the time take the sacrifice that women make to bring children into the world like as like nothing, as sort of like expected, as not being a huge emotional, physical, and financial cost to the women involved. So gay men who are even further removed from women, of course, are going to have those same views, and in some respects even be amplified, because they're not being checked by the women in their lives, or they don't have as much of an incentive not to say those negative things. Outside like the disregard for women and the disrespect of like these surrogate mothers through like examples like what I've just given, I also noticed that, and this is for couples across the board, like wealthy couples that come from like rich world countries and go to developing countries to like commission these children via surrogates, is that there's just a clear delineation between the surrogates and the egg donors. So what you will see is that like the surrogates who carry the children tend to come from like disadvantaged backgrounds. They tend to be poor women, but then the egg donors tend to come from like way wealthier backgrounds. Like they can tend to come from affluent backgrounds. So the donors, and don't forget what I said at the beginning, in that there's different types of surrogacies. Like some of them you use the donor egg, some of them you use like the surrogate's egg. So in cases where the egg has been taken from a different woman as a donor, and there are agencies as well that have this, like the majority of the time, the woman who has given her egg, the egg donor, is like a well-off, often white woman from a wealthy background. And she is selected for her genes. She's selected because she looks good, for her good health, often because she has some kind of like special talent. So maybe she's like good at maths and science. Maybe she's like a musical genius. And so when the parents are choosing their children, it almost feels like it's like a eugenics exercise in picking and choosing like the best genes for your child. And often it is on like racialized lines. And even outside like racialized lines, it's based on like even things like intellect and physical ability and mental ability. I came across like the baby Gammy case, where this Australian couple went to Thailand to commission a child via surrogacy, and the mother ended up having twins, and one of the twins was a girl, the other one was a boy. The boy ended up being born with Down syndrome, and what the parents did is that they took the child that wasn't born with a mental disability, that wasn't born with Down syndrome, was a little girl called Pippa. They took her home, but they left the boy with Down syndrome with a Thai surrogate mother, and she was left caring for a child she had not planned to have. She'd had it under the agreement of surrogacy where she was carrying it for their benefit. But when they discovered the mental disability, they left them there. And again, it speaks to what I was just saying in that surrogacy as well creates like an avenue for like eugenics processes and calculations that wouldn't be allowed in any other context. Like in any other context, you couldn't like eliminate a child, if you will, because the child had a mental disability. Like that's a crime. But somehow it's okay to like abandon children that didn't come out the way you wanted to. Like that's not what you paid for, and so you're essentially like returning to sender. So that's one thing I noticed, just like the cold calculations of choosing exactly not just how your child is going to look, but also even like the traits, down to the traits of what you want your child to be. So it's not again like the image or the myth that's presented by the surrogacy industry of like couples just being so desperate to have a child that they're grateful for any child they receive. No, they are like essentially going shopping. And if they're going to spend their money, they want to have like the most quote unquote premium child that money can buy them. Now, so far, I've just focused on the context and the issues surrounding surrogacy as a whole, but I haven't necessarily spoken about like what happens to women and what happens to like the babies and children after they're born. And, you know, one of the themes that became very clear when I was doing this research is like the bodily autonomy that women lose when they sign up for surrogacy, because the usual scenario is that they have to enter into an arrangement, a legal arrangement, where they agree that the commissioning couple will have final say over like what they eat, what they drink, when she's allowed to have sex with her partner or have sex in general. She will be sent to invasive medical tests throughout the pregnancy, and she can't say like she doesn't want to go. In countries where women have even less economic power, they're often required to stay at these like pregnancy clinics for the duration of their pregnancies, which means they're being removed from their families, their partners, their communities, and they're basically being isolated for the 9 to 10 months it takes to bring the child into the world. And then on top of that, when they're at these pregnancy clinics, they're being surveilled by these brokers who work for the agencies, and basically they keep them in line. They like are watching everything they do. They're making sure they're complying with their legal arrangement, and they're basically like confining them in such a way where the woman has very little say over her day-to-day like life. Like she can't just go say, I'm going to go to the shopping mall today or the shopping center for a bit of retail therapy. Like, no, she has to stay there under their watchful eye. Another thing as well, in terms of like the loss of bodily autonomy, is that they also have to consent, the surrogates, to having one or more of the fetuses aborted for any number of reasons. So that could be, for example, in the case where they use IVF and there are multiple births, or where there is a detection of abnormality, and basically this means like a physical deformation, or if they can tell that the child has like a mental disability. And so again, like this is extremely invasive. This is an extreme loss of bodily autonomy. Like in no other scenario could any single human, like outside like parent-child relationships, and even then they have those limitations, there's no scenario in which like women and girls are subjected to that level of physical control, that level of control over every aspect of their lives, including their intimate relationships. So like the bodily autonomy just is part, the loss of bodily autonomy is just part and parcel of these surrogacy agreements in general, like base level. Another thing that happens to surrogate mothers as well is that they're placed in higher health risks for the couple's convenience. So most like surrogates are required to like take these hormonal drugs like Lupron and estrogen and progesterone throughout their like pregnancies. And all these like medications, all these hormones have like serious side effects, or can have serious side effects, and do. And then on top of that, they're often required to undergo cesarean section as opposed to having a vaginal birth or a natural birth. And the reason why that is very simple. The commissioning parents want to control what date the woman gives birth to for their own convenience, so that they can ensure they're in town and they can ensure that, you know, it's a time that is convenient for them. And the thing about cesarean sections is that they pose an incredible level of risk to the woman and to the child as well. And they're really only supposed to be deployed under circumstances where it's unsafe for the mother to deliver for whatever reason, or it's like an emergency situation. And the risk isn't just like the risk that's associated with the operation in the moment and the things that could go wrong. It's also the post cesarean care. Like, the wound can get infected, can take a long time to heal. It can affect, like, because don't forget, they're cutting through like every layer of the stomach to get the child out. So it's going to affect like your abdominal muscle. It's going to affect like lots of layers in that area. And it has a much longer recovery period than a vaginal or natural birth. And often, like, there are complications and there are like records of women dying from like the complications that arise following the cesarean sections they've underwent as surrogate mothers. Outside like the bodily autonomy that's lost and the higher like health risks that they're put under, there's also like a great deal of emotional abuse where, and I would say this is the biggest thing that I really didn't know in terms of like the emotional aspect. I didn't know that like that in most of these contracts, these arrangements, that the women are stipulated by legal enforcement of that contract and by enforcement with like the clinical team that is delivering the child, that she's not allowed to touch the child. So she's carried the child for 9 to 10 months. She's formed a connection with that child. She's heard its heartbeat. She's seen it on the monitor. She's felt it grow in her. She's felt it kick. And then there's something in her contract that says that the minute the birth takes place, the minute the child is born, the clinical team, the team of physicians that are delivering the child take the child away from her straight away, and she never gets to see the child and she never gets to make physical contact. Like, to me, like, that sounds so traumatic. And not just traumatic, it sounds like unnecessarily cruel. Now, from the perspective of what happens to babies and what happens to children of surrogates, like, one of the things that really makes me sick is how underregulated the industry is. So when I talked about baby Gammy, like the Australian couple who left the child behind when they discovered the child had Down syndrome, like, that in itself was horrific in itself, because the woman was left with all the financial burden, already being a poor woman anyway. And that's why she was in the position to have to resort to surrogacy to make a living for herself and her family and her other kids. Outside of that and the cruelty of that, it turns out like the baby's father, like the biological father who commissioned the birth, like baby Gammy's like biological dad, like the sperm donor, the person who's going to take the baby home, turns out he was a convicted like sexual predator. He was convicted in 1999, the late 1990s, for molesting a girl under 10, and he ended up serving 3 years for that. And whilst he was serving 3 years, they found out that he'd been molesting and sexually abusing like two other girls. So he ends up like doing time for that as well. So one dreads to think about what the reason was for wanting to commission these children in the first place, and what their fate would have been, and what the fate of Pippa, the girl that he did take home, is or was. Another case I read about was like this Japanese billionaire who ordered 16 children from like different Thai clinics. There was also a man who ordered 300 babies from a Georgian surrogacy agency, and thankfully like the surrogacy agency declined. And the reason this man gave for wanting to commission 300 babies at the same time was that he had a very big family business, and he basically was commissioning the children so that when they grew up, they would be able to help out with the family business. Like, that's the reason they gave. Clearly, that's not the truth. They're like, even on a basic reasoning level, that doesn't make sense, because you'd have to wait like at least 10 to 12 years until these kids like became big enough to even do any meaningful work in this family business, quote unquote. And in the meantime, you would be paying for their food, for their clothing, for their education, for their healthcare. And this is for 300 children. Like, that cost is astronomical. Not to mention, it's unclear how you could ever give them the time and love and care required to, like, raise happy, healthy children. And even if we were to buy that story, like, which we don't, like, it's completely irrational. Like, the much more rational answer or explanation is that this man clearly was up to something incredibly sinister. Either he was commissioning the birth of these 300 babies because he intended to traffic them and sell them to couples who were seeking babies, or he was trafficking those babies for sexual exploitation. There's literally no other reason why anybody would ever need to have 300 babies at the same time. So, like, even the fact that he felt comfortable enough to request that implies that the regulation is incredibly loose. And whilst this agency in Georgia said no, there clearly is nothing preventing him from commissioning different amounts of kids from all over the world. So he might commission, like, two here, three there, and in total still over time be able to get those same 300 babies for the use of what is sure to be something incredibly evil. And whilst like these might be extreme cases of like what can happen or and what does happen because this industry is so underregulated, the fact is that those things still happened. And also the minor things that happen are still horrific. Like, there is an incredible lack of regulation around the medical standard that the mothers have access to. One of the documentaries I was watching was set in the Ukraine, and the couple who had commissioned their child had been sent all these promotional videos where they're showing these women in like these beautiful health clinics, these beautiful health centers with their own room, like everything pristine with like smiling doctors and clearly like a very nice like healthcare facility. Because of complications, the parents, the commissioning parents ended up having to fly to the Ukraine to be with their child, who ended up developing a life-threatening health condition. And when they got to the facility where the woman, the surrogate mother, had been housed for all this time and where she was receiving care, the couple was incredibly horrified from what they saw. It was honestly like the stuff of nightmares. Like, the baby's crib where they expected for the baby that was already vulnerable and sick and needed like specialist care was stained with like urine and blood. The mother's bed was no better. There was like cockroaches going around. I saw another couple who went to Mexico to commission a set of twins to be born as well. And those circumstances had the surrogate mother, undergoing operation in the most vile of health centers where it was just completely filthy. Like, the chances that she would have gotten an infection from that place was basically like guaranteed. So again, like, the lack of regulation basically means that not only are these women like probably being exploited in a lot of circumstances, either by people in their lives, like in the case of what I was talking about of like the criminal gangs in like in countries like India, or because of like abusive partners who coerce their wives or girlfriends into like going into surrogacy work for their own benefit, or the case of surrogate agencies where the women are supposed to get X amount of money per month for the services they're providing, but the agencies end up actually creaming a significant amount of the money that's destined, that was supposed to go to the woman for themselves. Like, even outside of that, even outside of like the lack of regulation around those issues, the lack of like regulation around like the minimum care that a woman should get to maximize the chances that she's not going to be forever impacted negatively by this birth or by this pregnancy isn't there either. Especially when you're talking about a situation where 60 to 75% of like surrogates are like from developing countries that are not going to have like the best or equivalently like safe medical facilities, you know, like basically they're compromising their health risks in so many respects by this lack of regulation. Again, speaks to what I was talking about at the top of the episode, in that the women are probably doing it out of like economic desperation. Otherwise, why put yourself in such risks from all these things I've described, like the risk of like the agency not paying you, the risk of something going wrong because you're not getting the proper healthcare facility, or you're in a healthcare facility that is incredibly under-resourced and understaffed and is basically like a cesspit for infections. Or also just the regulation around not being exploited by these wealthy couples who hold all the power, because ultimately you need the money that they have promised you. And so you're going to dance to their tune until you get that money. And given that you have to dance to their tune for the 9 to 10 months where you're pregnant with their child, that's a long period for exploitation. Now, so far I've given like the worst case scenario for surrogacy. So I presented like all the negative components, and I guess like people who are supporters of surrogacy would say exactly that, in that I'm presenting it in a skewed way. But I honestly think that even when you look at the best case scenario, and the best case scenario being altruistic surrogacy where it isn't for profit, so the women are doing it not because they need the money, and so you're removing a lot of the economic coercion incentives that might be taking place, and they're only doing it to be of service to a couple that can't have children for whatever reason. And so instead of getting paid like, I don't know, $50,000 or $100,000, depending on where they're from or where they're living. And actually, by the way, like women in developing countries are earning significantly less than that. Like think about like $5,000, $7,000, like closer to that. Like the $50,000 is for an American woman or a woman in Canada, for example. So even outside all of the economic coercion stuff I talked about earlier, and even when it's just like expenses-based arrangements where the women are just going to be compensated for the reasonable expenses that accrue to them, note that like the reasonable expenses that countries like the UK allow, so the £15,000 or like $18,000 I spoke about earlier, is still like a lot of money for like low income women. Like there are women who might only make £21,000 a year. And so if they only make around 21,000 a year, or even if they made like £25,000 a year, £15,000 in reasonable expenses is extremely lucrative money for them. In some circumstances, depending on where they live, it can be life-changing money. Because don't forget, when they say reasonable expenses, there's no list of things that are allowed under that category. It's very, very loose. It's very, very open to broad interpretation. So reasonable expense might mean paying rent. It might be paying for their car. It might be contributing to a down payment for a home. It could literally mean anything that they can use to explain that they need for their pregnancy. So clearly like the economic consideration or like the financial factor or incentive is never fully removed, even when it's only expenses based, especially when the expenses like budget or ceiling is as high as £15,000 or $18,000. And actually there's a lot of evidence to show or suggest that even in like an expenses based system like the UK, like a lot of women still get paid under the table to sweeten the deal. So you can never fully remove the financial incentive or the financial motivation driving like women into surrogacy, which means that again, like chances are they are doing it out of economic necessity or out of being like not on the breadline, but fearing basically like falling into a bad cycle of poverty if they don't resort to this. Now, the final thing I'll comment on in terms of the best case scenario for like surrogacy or for advocates of surrogacies is that even when they say like there is no economic coercion and that it can be regulated to mitigate all the risks that I talked about in terms of like the woman's loss of bodily autonomy, the idea she might be being coerced by a partner or an agency guaranteeing that the children go to safe homes, even if you remove all of that, like clearly there's still a contradiction at the center of international surrogacy specifically, because they say on the one hand that the women are perfectly happy to do this. They understand it's an arrangement and that they're doing it to facilitate another couple or another person like having a child and having a family of their own, and that these are all like agreements that are based on consent and that the both parties are happy to come to the table and it's like an even exchange in the sense that the woman isn't left feeling worse off than if she hadn't like done it. And they also tell us that the women like aren't emotionally connected to the children. They don't feel a sense of loss. They don't feel a sense of regret. They don't pine for their children that they've given birth to and given away to the couple. They say all of this, in particular the last component, the last part about them not feeling any emotional connection or emotional toil. But then they also like simultaneously try very hard to basically prevent women from acting on their natural instincts, those instincts being wanting the child that they have carried and given birth to. So in the legal arrangement that I spoke about, in the contracts that they enter into, it'll stipulate not just that she will not keep the child because the child is for has been commissioned and paid for by the couple, for the couple. So it says she's not going to keep the child. They also are so fearful and are so aware of the emotional bond the mother clearly is going to have and does have with her child or the child that she's given birth to that they stipulate she can't even touch that child. She can't look at that child. She can't form any physical connection to the child. And the minute that the child is born, it must be taken away from her before she ever gets a chance to do those things. Clearly, not only is that a recognition of the fact that the women might have conflicting feelings about what they're doing, and there's such a high chance that that might happen that it's better to never even give her the opportunity to have that moment of like weakness, if you will. They're also telling you that they're willing to subject the woman to the trauma of the child being ripped away from her, despite them knowing what the cost is likely to be to her. And despite them knowing that for her own closure, she probably would want to touch a child and hold the child and breastfeed the child and have at least like one night or one evening or one day with the child before she's forced to let it go forever. So honestly, like on the one hand, like they're saying, like these are completely like emotionless commercial transactions where there is no like human emotions involved in terms of like the women forming connections. But then they're also like putting or implementing all these measures to guarantee that the women's like emotions don't compromise like their ability to receive their final product, quote unquote. Another thing as well within this is they're essentially admitting that the woman is being coerced emotionally into giving up the child. Because if it was truly informed consent, they would allow the woman to know all the information before making the decision about giving away the child. All the information means how she's going to feel in the moment when the child is born and she's held the child, she's smelled the child, she's breastfed the child, she spent some time with the child, and knowing all she knows, still chooses to give away the child. So it's like, even in the best case scenario, it's still not based on informed consent because the woman clearly doesn't know that she's going to feel that connection before she signed the contract. And why? And after she signs the contract, like her fate is sealed. It doesn't matter if she carries for the rest of her life the trauma of having been like separated from her child, like she can't go back on it because, you know, the contracts are specifically designed to be signed before the woman is able to have all the information. And really, when I was watching some of the documentaries, it was really, really sad to see, like especially the ones I saw in like these Georgian, like essentially baby factories, where the women who, even after they'd done it a previous time, like still were unprepared for the level of guilt and sadness and feelings of having abandoned their child that they felt, you know? So it's a huge emotional toll that the surrogacy industry is sort of pretending that like doesn't exist, because in their view, they would kind of like us to perceive these women, these surrogate mothers, as essentially like vessels, like emotionless vessels. Another thing to note as well is like to what extent the surrogacy industry and advocates of surrogacy in general will go to remove the woman's like importance and significance in the whole transaction. So not only is there like an erasure of the mother in every sense of the word, so legally she's not going to be recognized as the mother, the language erodes even that idea that she's a mother. So even the use of the word surrogate as opposed to surrogate mother, or as opposed to like mother or birthing mother, is designed to create a sense of separation from the mother and her motherhood, if you will. There's also, of course, like the legal part where she doesn't have any legal rights to the child. And then also in language, like one of the things you notice when celebrities have like children via surrogacies is how absent most of the time the surrogates are from the story. So they might post like a cute picture of like a little hand or a little foot, and they'll say, "We're so happy to welcome baby," like insert whatever name. And they won't say like, "We owe a debt of gratitude to the surrogate mother who brought this baby into this world," or "We thank the mother who gave birth to the child for the tremendous physical and psychological and emotional sacrifice she made to allow us to have this child." Like, she is literally rendered invisible, as though she was like a byline in the whole story of how the child came to be, as opposed to the actual person without whom the child wouldn't be there. So there's an erasure in just like the lack of mentioning and centering her in the story, in like the family story or the birthing story. And we even see that in like well-meaning healthcare institutions like the NHS, like the UK health system, has also bought into this line of like the erasure of like women and specifically surrogate mothers, in that they refer to them as like carriers, or they refer to them in like really degendered like language. So they'll refer to, for example, birthing parents, but they won't mention mothers in a lot of publications, even though they do mention fathers. So again, like to me, like this language is specifically designed, or if not designed, speaks to the perception or like the belief that women, and in particular in this case like surrogate mothers, are like essentially like just rented wombs. They're carriers, they're vessels who are detached from like essentially like human beings. Otherwise, like the contracts would be a lot more humane, like the interaction between like commissioning parents and commissioning agencies would be a lot more humane. They would factor in the emotional well-being, they would factor in the centrality of the surrogate mother in the whole story of how the child came to be. There would be a lot more regulation and protection for women in terms of like the healthcare they receive, like them being able to hold on to their bodily autonomy, them being able to be guaranteed that they are going to be paid the money they were promised, them having access to like long-term post-pregnancy care, because complications develop like later. It's not just like in the weeks after childbirth. It can be like a year or 2 years later afterwards. So if, you know, all these things would be in place if there wasn't that desire to reduce the woman's contribution to the, like, to the existence of children, if you will, to just that of like an empty facilitator, of like a vessel, like I said. So after I sort of did like a deeper dive into what I believe about surrogacy, you know, like what I've just taken you through, you know, I had a few takeaways, like zooming out from the specifics. One of my takeaways was like, of course, I like completely understand like the longing and desire to like, one, have your own child that's biologically yours, to have a child where you have them from the beginning, and therefore you have the opportunity to shape how they're going to be, like their character, their morals, their aspirations, the kind of adult they're going to be. Three, the desire to like have someone to love and give love to, and to like form a family unit. And for many people, like love without children feels incomplete, because we're very much socialized to believe that. And so even when they're in a great union or a great relationship, they still feel like a biological child, a child they've had since a baby, since the child was a baby, like will complete their incomplete unit, if you will. And then, you know, finally as well, I genuinely do feel like people have a biological need to reproduce, to like ensure that their own bloodline, if you will, is continued, to have a legacy that can be traced down or traced back to their own genes. it might be like a little bit of an egotistical or selfish like desire, but that desire also is there. It's the reason why, like, even sometimes people who said in their younger years don't want to have children, they sometimes, like, when they get older, like, have this overwhelming desire that they can't explain that goes against everything they've intellectualized, and they find themselves like wanting children. Or even there's like this show that I watch on TV sometimes that traces people's family, so people are disconnected or lost to their parents for whatever reason, maybe it's through adoption or through war, and basically like they use the help of like a genealogist and like a DNA expert to find their lost family. And what you'll find is that gay men sometimes register with like sperm donation or sperm donor agencies, because on some level they hope that somewhere out there, like, their genes are being carried forward. So on one of these episodes, there was like a gay man who had contacted the show because he said that he had donated sperm to an agency, and he was, you know, he was getting to his later years, and he was curious to see if anybody might have come looking for him. And he was saying it in terms of, or framing it in terms of, he would hate to think that a child out there is looking for him and is looking for answers, and he's around and doesn't give them those answers. But when the DNA expert came back and said that they had looked extensively and they couldn't find in any of their databases anybody who had been seeking for him, you could tell he was honestly very disappointed. You could tell that secretly he hoped that somebody might have been out there carrying his genes. Somebody might have been out there that was his child. So again, like, this is a deeply seated desire to have biological children, regardless of your sexual orientation and regardless of sort of like your individual circumstances. That being said though, like, that desire is not the same thing as having a right to a child, especially when having that child involves so many potential and actual negative consequences on the woman. Because it is the woman who is like the biggest loser in all of this. Like, no matter how you slice and dice it, to me, even if none of those bad things happened to me, like, I wasn't exploited financially, I wasn't abused by the commissioning parents, I wasn't in like a cesspit of like a healthcare center whilst I was like giving birth or confined to these clinics for the 10 months that I was pregnant, even outside of that, like, I don't think $18,000 is enough compensation for bringing life into this world. Like, the way that women's labor and in general is so minimized is honestly outrageous. $18,000 for giving life to somebody, for bringing life into this world, for giving somebody a family, is an incredible, like, underappreciation and underpayment of women's labor and women's bodies, in my view, anyway. And on top of that, like, nobody has a right to have access to women's bodies, like full stop, point blank, period. And actually, even when I think about like the underplaying of women's contributions, I think it even reflects in the way that, like, the discourse around surrogacy takes place from the perspective of opponents. So opponents will often say, like, you know, this is essentially like wombs for rent. Like, this is essentially rent a womb. This is basically like couples of every variety who can't have children using a woman's womb for the realization of their own dreams. But even that is like it's like a distortion of what's happening. It's a minimization of what the actual true cost is, because it isn't just the womb that's being affected whilst the woman is pregnant. It's not just like the rest of her is completely fine. It just happens to be like this component of her body is sort of like growing and being affected by the child that's inside that cavity. It's like, no, her brain chemistry is going to be extremely altered, as are her hormones. They're going to literally be like out of whack for the duration of her pregnancy and even after the fact. It's a reason why, for example, some women suffer from postpartum depression, because their hormones have been negatively impacted and are skewed after undergoing pregnancy. There's also going to be profound changes to her bone structure or to her skeletal system that is going to have to change and grow and expand and become more flexible to accommodate the growing child, especially around the hips and around like the trunk. Her heart is also going to be affected. Her lungs are going to be affected. Also, her vaginal canal, especially during birth, is going to be affected. Many women experience rips and tears that have like a long-lasting effect. Also, her digestive system is affected. Her mental health, like honestly, like every component almost of her body is affected. So even when like surrogacy advocates talk about like why surrogacy is immoral or unjust or exploitative of women, even the way that they approach the conversation is inherently diminishing of like the true cost to women, the true cost of pregnancy to women. My other takeaway as well is when I was just looking up like the number of celebrities who have given, not given birth because they haven't given birth, who have had children via surrogacy, it is actually a huge number. Like it is an incredibly larger number than you would expect. And when I looked at these celebrities and I looked at their ages and I looked at who they are and I looked at their careers, I honestly couldn't help but feel that a large reason why they choose to have children via surrogacy is not because they can't conceive, is not because like their bodies can't carry the child to full term, or they're not in relationships, or they don't have access to just like healthcare facilities like IVF or whatever. I'm telling you, it's out of convenience. It's out of them exercising the privilege because they've got so much money. And because they're in an industry that is so body conscious, like Hollywood, as we know, is so body conscious to the point where people go to extreme lengths to stay thin. Like, I remember when I used to watch like documentaries around how like models stayed thin or stayed skinny. It was them like eating cotton wool soaked in apple vinegar, or it's like people getting liposuction. It's people undergoing these extreme procedures to stay thin. And the reason why they undergo these extreme procedures is because literally their incomes are dependent on how physically they look. Even actors, like you would think that an actor's value is only or primarily in how good of an actor they are. But we've all seen many a shitty actor who somehow is in a blockbuster or somehow is given all these like role film opportunities. And the only reason why they're being given these opportunities is because they look good. They look good visually. They look good physically. And so in terms of like looking at women who choose to go the surrogacy route, women and their partners, like a lot of the times because they don't want to lose their bodies. They know that their financial pockets are going to take a hit if they have to take 9 to 10 months out to have the child. And then the amount of time it takes to like get back into shape or snap back, if you will, to say nothing of all the other things like breastfeeding and the changes to your body. You know, like a lot of the time, like what I have observed is honestly, it's because they can afford to do so because it's convenient for them and because they don't want to take like the social hit and the financial hit from carrying the child themselves. So they are literally like the caricature of what the whole like discussion and arguments in the surrogacy debates are. You basically have these people who have extreme levels of wealth, and because they don't want to inconvenience themselves and because they have access to this, they go to like countries like the Ukraine where the average income is like $10,000 a year or something. And they pay them, they chuck a few coins at these poor women or women in Georgia or women in Thailand or wherever these women are, and they chuck some change at them and they transfer all the physical, health, emotional risks to that woman. And the only reason they can do so is because of the income inequality that I spoke about at the beginning of the episode and the disparity in income and being able to essentially use their economic standing, their financial standing, their wealth status in a way that compromises or puts at risk another woman. And even when you look at like celebrities like Kim Kardashian, who she gave, she had her last child, her and Kanye West had their last child via surrogacy. Like it's unclear why this woman who already has 3 children has to use another woman's body to have a fourth. you know? And she said the reason why she went the surrogacy route was because she nearly died in her last pregnancy. Okay, so if she herself nearly died, she clearly understands the risks that pregnancy poses. So why would she want to transfer that risk to another woman? Like, no matter how you slice it, it honestly is very ugly. And it's heightened when you realize to what extent or how callous the calculation is in circumstances like that. Especially because she can't even use the narrative that surrogacy advocates like to use, that, you know, it's a woman who can't conceive or can't have a children, and she's so desperate to have her own family that she resorts to like using another woman's body to have a child. Like, even in this scenario and in the celebrity scenarios, like, they literally, like, most of the time are making calculations based on selfishness and convenience. Another thing I thought about as well outside of that is I just wonder what the experience is for surrogate mothers like a year after they've given up the child, or 2 years later, or 10 years later. Because I kind of imagine it to be like the way that women feel who have had to give up their children for adoption for whatever reason, because they couldn't look after them or because they were conceived under bad or sad or difficult circumstances. Like, what these women often express, they often say that they long and still pine for the child that they gave up for adoption, and that they wish that the circumstances would have been different so that they would have been able to like keep their child. And sometimes they also recount about how traumatic the experience was of having to physically give away the child that they have just had just given birth to. And so with surrogate mothers, because they express similar feelings of attachment, of longing, of sadness, of trauma, honestly, at having to let go of the children, I wonder if they have the same lifelong longing for the child. Maybe they wish that under different economic circumstances, they never would have had to put themselves through that. And or that they would have been able to keep the child. So I just, you know, I wonder if there's any study out there that looks at the surrogates specifically like 10 years down the line to see how they feel about the choice they made. And then the final thing I'll say is that, like, the way I feel like the surrogacy discussion is presented, it's presented as though like having a biological child is like the only way to have like a family, to have a child. But like, there are literally millions of children out there in every country who don't have homes, who are in the foster care system, who are wards of the state, who would love to find their forever home, as I said, who could use somebody who has that level of disposable income to go the surrogacy route, to spend that money on them, to provide them with love, a safe home and protection, to provide them with education and other forms of like financial support, to give them the resources and care and structure and family that they otherwise will never get inside the foster care system, especially in the context of all we know about the foster care system that is rife with sexual abuse, that is rife with other forms of abuse. And also we know that the trajectory of children who've been in the foster care system are honestly terrifyingly terrible. Like, the level of propensity for like drug abuse, the propensity to end up in prison, the propensity to drop out of education, like the trajectory is absolutely terrible. So the way that the surrogacy discussion is taking place is they're making it seem as though like adoption isn't an option. And whilst it might take longer to have a child because the parents are like rigorously assessed, that in itself isn't persuasive enough for me to say that you should abandon it, because you should want as rigorous a vetting process as possible, because you want to make sure that the children end up in safe homes where there are no negative or ulterior motives, and that they're going to be placed in homes where their needs can be fulfilled. So the duration it takes for adoption to me is not persuasive enough. And if it is the case that people have gone through the adoption route and were rejected for adoption, then those people shouldn't have children anyway. Because like, the reasons why you're rejected for adoption is because you can't provide the level of care that would fulfill a child's like developmental needs, or you're not safe for whatever reason. So like, we shouldn't even be allowing these people to have access to children anyhow. And outside people who just like want biological children, I would just invite them to realize that adopted families and adopted children, they're not inferior. They're not inferior forms of family structures. They're not inferior forms of love. Like, you can and do develop as deep a bond and as deep a connection with them if you view them in the same way as you view them as your own child. Because part of the reason why people feel such love for their children is because they're invested in them, like, at every single level. And so if you apply the same level, like the same investment and same connection and same dedication and same like depth of commitment to adopted children and making your adopted family like this magical family structure, of course it's going to be very, very rewarding. And on top of that, like, the children who you give a forever home to will always be grateful that you gave them like a chance at life. And with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you listen to the very end, I would really appreciate if you left me a 5-star review wherever you get your episodes or a podcast from. Just helps people find the podcast. I also like nearly always leave like materials you might find helpful in the show notes, and this is basically like links to interesting articles I came across in my research or that just discusses the topic that I've covered, and most of them tend to be like not behind a paywall, so yeah, check that out, you might find that interesting. I'll be back next Monday as usual, hopefully like earlier in the day. I made a tactical mistake, I should have just recorded last night, and then my mic broke, as I said, so this is coming in really late if you're listening on the 13th. But yeah, hopefully back early in the morning next Monday. Enjoy the rest of your week and speak then.